Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. John Roberts became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 2005, appointed by President George W. Bush. Since then, his court has ruled on gun control, health care, gay rights, campaign finance, and much more. A pattern of close-fought 5-4 decisions has left the court facing a reputation as politically or ideologically riven, as polarized and polarizing in its way as Congress. Big court thinker and constitutional scholar Lawrence Tribe says it's more complicated than that. This month, the High Court wraps up its current session. It's a good time to size things up. This hour on Point, Lawrence Tribe on the Roberts Court and where it's taking the country. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see a political court, an active court, or activist? Where is the Roberts Court taking us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Go back to 2005, confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. After his nomination by George W. Bush, here was John Roberts saying a Supreme Court justice should be like a baseball umpire.
Judges and justices are servants of the law, not the other way around. Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules, but it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire.
Just calling balls and strikes. Well, it may be a little deeper than that. Joining me now in the studio is Lawrence Tribe, constitutional law professor at Harvard University, co-author with Joshua Matz of the big new book, Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court, and the Constitution. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Lawrence Tribe has argued dozens of cases before the Supreme Court, including Bush v. Gore, the case that decided the year 2000 presidential race. His own name has often been lofted for court membership. Lawrence Tribe, welcome back to On Point. It's wonderful to have you here.
Wonderful to be here, Tom.
So there's so much to look at here. You write about this with such wonderful nuance and depth. But let's just go to the big billboard concern about this court. And many people describe it, that somehow our polarization that we see in politics has made its way onto the high court itself, which we like to imagine is somehow apart and above the political fray. Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times writing that she's even concerned that it's gone from the court reflecting our political polarization to actively becoming a generator of political polarization. Do you see an unusually, an exceptional, a disturbingly political court emerging under John Roberts?
Well, I do think it's more complicated than that. The court has always been at the vortex of politics. There's no way for it to be completely above the fray because the issues that it grapples with, the meaning of ambiguous constitutional language, the content of liberty, of equality, the proper relation between the federal government and the states, those are not matters that can be solved as though they were, you know, mathematical equations. The court, therefore, is often divided on the toughest questions, not as divided as some people seem to think. The last term, for example, 49% of the decisions were unanimous. And when they are 5-4, they're by no means always the predictable 5-4. Mm-hmm. For example, Breyer is very much to the right of Scalia on most issues involving privacy. Sotomayor parted from her liberal colleagues.
And by right, you meaning more protective of privacy?
Well, Breyer is less protective of privacy than Scalia.
Okay.
And one would have expected, as a liberal nominee, that he might be more protective. Mm-hmm. There are dozens of examples like that in the book. And what's really interesting is that if you are trying to convince yourself that the court is just like an umpire, really to buy the image that John Roberts tried to sell, you're not really going to do very well because, as Justice Kagan pointed out in her confirmation hearings, the hardest cases are ones where judges are in fact not simply applying mechanical rules, they are deciding what the rules ought to be.
Isn't that the very heart of the Supreme Court's function? He said, just like an umpire suggesting calling balls and strikes, but doesn't the court kind of define home plate itself?
And it defines the strike zone, and mm-hmm. it defines what a lot of the rules are supposed to be. What we want, the respect in which the umpire image is right, is we don't want the court calling it so that the home team wins, calling it so that the team that it wants to win in a particular dispute takes home the pennant.
Because of a partisan affection for that.
Because of a partisan affection or some personal interest. But these people serve for life. There's a reason that they do. They owe nothing to the president who appointed them, to the political party who got them there. And very often they depart from the favorite ideology of the political forces that put them in positions of power. If we want to understand how this enormously powerful institution shapes our lives on everything from our sexual choices to whether mm-hmm. we raise our families one way or another, to who can own a gun, to whether you will be confronted with a gun in the public square, we've got to get beyond this notion that it's all a matter of politics.
But
it's,
why is the notion more potently out there today, or is it? I mean, we had Justice Breyer himself, this was just a week or two ago, at the annual meeting of the American Law Institute, saying that members of the court were being viewed as, quoting the justice here, were being viewed as junior varsity politicians. Why is that perception out there under the Roberts Court?
Comments like Justice Breyer's, much as I admire and like him and consider him a friend, can become self-fulfilling prophecies. I think the only antidote is to convince people through an accessible narrative with detailed stories about the kinds of cases that get to the court and how they get resolved, that the philosophical differences among the justices, their different life experiences, what they bring to the job, are the things that explain how differently they see the problems before them. It's not that some are Democrats and some are Republicans. You can pick certain areas like affirmative action, where political party is a pretty good predictor of where they'll come out, but not always. A Republican like Kennedy has frustrated his other Republican colleagues by refusing to deal the death blow to race-specific affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And even when the court is unanimous, the standard trope that says, look at the 5-4s and make judgments about it politically, even when the court is unanimous, as it was yesterday in this strange case about a woman who poisoned her best friend when she learned that he was also her husband's lover. Mm-hmm. When the court unanimously said that the federal government has no business prosecuting her, the fact that several justices, in this case Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, and Justice Alito, reached that conclusion in a very different way from Chief Justice Roberts and the other members of the court, that tells you a lot more about where the court is taking the country in the future in terms of the kinds of issues that were involved in that case. Unanimity can often conceal deep and important and interesting divisions within the court. There are fights between Kagan and Sotomayor on how best to approach the impact of new technology on personal privacy. Mm-hmm. There are fights between Scalia and Alito on whether we should pay great attention to the original expectations and the original meaning of the Constitution. In one case involving the sale of violent videos without full parental approval to children, where the Supreme Court struck down California's attempt to regulate that kind of sale. Justice Alito from the bench tried to simplify things by saying what Justice Scalia really wants to know is, did James Madison enjoy video games? There's another case involving searches of cars, not by rummaging through them, but by mm-hmm. sticking a GPS onto them and then following them around mm-hmm. and tracking them, mm-hmm. where the court, though unanimously holding that this was something that requires regulation under the Fourth Amendment, you need a warrant for certain kinds of GPS tracking, split dramatically. Justice Scalia said that the reason that this is subject to the Constitution's warrant requirement, is that there's an invasion of the property of the car. Justice Alito said that's got nothing to do with it. It wouldn't make any difference if they followed you from a distance with a remote GPS. In fact, trying to make an 18th century analogy out of it, he said, is just ridiculous. What is the 18th century analogy to a GPS? Well, Scalia came up with one. He's a very clever fellow. He said, you know, there could be a constable hiding in someone's coach and following the coach around. And Alito quite cleverly rejoindered, well, only if it was a giant coach and a very tiny and very patient constable would that work. In other words, the attempt to make an 18th century document do the work of a 21st century society without looking at the deeper underlying values of the Constitution is bound to fail. And we're bound to have judges with different views about those underlying values. Why else have nine of them? Why not just have an algorithm, a computer program, and have a robot decide it all? It seems to me that we have to get used to the idea that the fact that the nine judges on these deep philosophical issues that affect the meaning of the Constitution and its impact on our lives are going to come at it from nine different perspectives is exactly what we want. That's why we have nine of them. That's why we should pay much more attention than we sometimes do to the experience and the worldviews of the people who serve on that court.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Roberts Court, our Supreme Court now, and where it's taking the country with constitutional law professor at Harvard University, Lawrence Tribe. He's just out with Joshua Matz with a new book, Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, going in great detail, great nuance, looking at these nine court members and how they are approaching such a wide array of issues lately. John Roberts at his confirmation hearings back in 2005, saying, every case, an open mind.
Mr. Chairman, I come before the committee with no agenda. I have no platform. Judges are not politicians who can promise to do certain things in exchange for votes. I have no agenda, but I do have a commitment. If I am confirmed, I will confront every case with an open mind.
Lawrence Tribe joins me in the studio. Just a variety of responses here already online. There are a lot, but here's one. John says, glad for the Roberts Court. Protect the Constitution from liberals. Dana says, what's he got here? The Roberts Court consists of a majority of corporate henchmen. And then we've got Yar who writes, John Roberts is the Apostle Paul. Before his conversion on the road to Damascus, we can pray for his conversion. What have you learned in the years of John Roberts sitting as Chief Justice about his view of the world, the Constitution?
Well, I've learned that when he said he had an open mind, he certainly didn't mean that it was a blank mind. There were things there. He had views, strong views, and the country could have learned a lot about them if it looked more closely at his record. He's what most people would regard as a conservative on some issues, a liberal on others. I mean, just take the Obamacare decision, for example. I was among the very few people who predicted that John Roberts would in the end cast a decisive vote based on Congress's taxing power. That is, it was not really a mandate to buy insurance. It was a higher tax on those who didn't as a kind of social responsibility tax. Some people thought he was betraying a conservative philosophy. But I think that uses a term like conservative much too loosely. It's a conservative principle that people should pay for the consequences of their behavior, and people who are uninsured often impose costs on others. At the same time, joined by two supposed liberals, by Breyer and Kagan, he rendered a decision 7-2, striking down what Congress did when it required states to accept, with lots of federal inducement, to accept a broader form of Medicaid coverage. That was apparently a victory for Obama's foes. But when you look at both parts of the decision striking down the mandate that states have higher Medicaid coverage, and the decision upholding the higher tax for people who don't buy insurance, both parts represented a common theme, an underlying philosophy that the majority of this court seems to share, and that is coercion should be the last resort, that if you can nudge people into more socially responsible behavior and encourage states to engage in it, that's an alternative that's constitutionally preferable to coercion. In most of these cases where the first line reaction is, oh, the conservatives won this part, the liberals won that part, that doesn't tell you very much about the future of the court and therefore of the country. You have to look beneath that surface to see what principles united the court. And there are some principles that do not divide the court along the standard partisan or political lines. But of course, the court is divided in the sense that you don't expect nine bright people with substantial life experience to look at these constitutional terms the same way. When John, one of your callers, said protect the Constitution from liberals, he had a certain kind of constitution in mind and obviously a certain group of people in mind when he said liberals. But other people will look at the Constitution, the same document, in all good faith and see some rather different principles. I think it's far past time that we stopped simplifying it all to take back the Constitution. It's my Constitution. You guys are outsiders. We're all one country. We're struggling with one document that connects us to a profound past. We all want it, I think, to move us toward a more just future. We want Martin Luther King's vision of the arc of justice to hold. But for that to hold, we have to engage in a more serious national conversation about what these constitutional values are. Saying that the current court, for example, is right-leaning when it comes to equality simply because it won't go along with the standard liberal position on affirmative action is a radical oversimplification. This court is quite libertarian when it comes to gay rights. And there are legitimate differences among people's ways of looking at affirmative action. There's a wonderful dispute between Justice Thomas on the court and Justice Sotomayor, in which both of them say that the greatest evil is to be made to feel that you don't belong. And what Justice Sotomayor has learned from her life's history is that unless we take some affirmative steps to include people of diverse racial backgrounds, minorities will always feel that they don't belong. What Justice Thomas learned from his experience is that he feels he doesn't belong even now because people suspect that he got where he got because of affirmative action, and they don't think he's as smart as his colleagues know he is. Well, those are two very legitimate different views, and my idea and my co-author's idea in writing this book was that it underestimates the intelligence of the American public to insist on simplifying all these things to right versus wrong, black versus white, liberal versus conservative, activist versus restrained. We have to get beneath those labels, beneath the bumper stickers, in order to understand what the legitimate differences are. And there are plenty of things to be said on all sides of most disputes serious enough to reach the United States Supreme Court.
So let me just, I mean, you are so well versed in this. You see all this nuance, but I'm not, still there's a kind of in toto bottom line somewhere. Every court changes the country. Every opinion changes the country, you write. They interpret the Constitution differently, and it with that it is different. And as you write, with that our lives are different, and so the possible futures that spin out before us are different.
Well, they're very different, but the attempt to add up all those little vectors and say the net result is we have a right-leaning court, which is what most of my liberal friends say as a matter of sort of the catechism, I think does a disservice to
is
the
it
court and the country.
Is it an equal and opposite response to what we used to hear a generation ago about earlier courts when it was conservatives making that kind of summary judgment?
Sure. When people said impeach Earl Warren because he was the author of the unanimous opinion in Brown v. Board of Education, that was an oversimplification as well. There were important values on all sides of these issues. Nothing in a way, has really changed. The court has always been at the vortex of deep dispute. But now, because we have an instantaneous reaction to everything on the internet, hundreds of blogs covering every aspect of government and politics, including the court, a 24/7 news cycle, there really isn't as much time as there was once to digest the deeper meaning of any of these things. And so people yearn to get to some simple answer. I mean, H.L. Mencken once said, and I think we quote him in the book,
yes, you do,
that for every complicated problem, there is a simple solution. And it's almost always wrong. For the complicated problem of characterizing the court, there are simple solutions. You can slap a label on it, but it doesn't tell you very much, and you do yourself a disservice by not looking at the rich history. Most people have assumed that only lawyers and law students can understand that stuff. Well, I can tell you, after 40 years of teaching lawyers and law students, but also undergraduates, that you don't have to be an expert to understand it. Sometimes legal mumbo-jumbo and expertise gets in the way. If you think hard about what choices are being made and are a bright, engaged person, you can understand this stuff. What I'm out to prove in this book is that we underestimate our fellow citizens if we think we have to simplify and reduce and add it all up and say, on balance, here's where the court is going. It's going in 9 directions at once, and we have more than 9 futures ahead of us. And it's not all determined. It depends a lot on who the next president is, who the next Senate is, when justices resign. It's not all fated.
I may be that blinkered common man. I see different directions, but overall, I don't see 9 lately. It does seem more polarized than that to me. I mean, here's Justice John Paul Stevens. He just left the court a handful of years ago. Let's just take one. Okay, maybe the whole direction or drift is hard to summarize, but just take campaign finance and money in politics.
Sure, there's a clear direction.
Justice Stevens,
in that.
And he says here, this court is taking a giant step in the wrong direction. Now, this is not an uninformed man. This is a former member of the High Court.
And someone who dissented when the court decided that the direction some people wanted to take in restricting expenditures on speech by corporations and by the wealthy was inconsistent with the First Amendment. Now, I would have been myself more likely a dissenter in that case. But we don't do ourselves any service by assuming that we can solve the problems posed by money in politics by giving the very politicians that we think are bought and paid for the power to draft new regulations. The real solution is a combination of things, including greater transparency. But the people who got there the way these guys did keep voting against the transparency that this court, by a vote of 8-1, said would be perfectly constitutional. It said that Congress has the power to enact a law making clear that everybody will know which corporations and which wealthy individuals supported which 30-second ad or which 60-second ad. But Congress hasn't done it. So taking Justice Stevens' solution of amending the Constitution to give Congress greater power in this area may itself not be much of a solution. It's not so clear how to solve a lot of these problems. The problem of money in politics is so deep, so pervasive, that a little patch here and a little patch there is not likely to make a huge difference.
But would you see the Roberts Court as putting us on a path to much greater corporate power and or power of wealthy individuals in our democracy by their interpretation of the court on this of the Constitution?
I'm
on this
afraid
front.
I agree that greater power has been given to the wealthy as a result of some of these interpretations, which is why I suggested that I would not have gone along with some of those decisions. But you have to be clear-headed about it. Money in politics has been pervasive anyway. It's as though you're completely drenched head to toe. And the question is, you know, at that point, does it do much good to put up a little umbrella? It's not clear that it does much good. The power of money in lobbying, for example, lobbying legislators, is much greater than the power of money in deciding who will win or who will lose a particular election.
But these distinctions are a big deal. Suddenly there's no limit on what people can contribute to races all around the country. That's a very big checkbook.
It's
and
it's a
time
huge
of inequality.
Change.
People look at that and say, wow, where does that take
us? Well, in fact, Citizens United was an important wake-up call. Even before Citizens United, corporations could spend all they wanted on elections as long as they didn't name the candidate and say, vote for X or against Y. The only difference, literally, that Citizens United made was to say, well, no longer do you have to use the magic words, you can name the candidate. That in itself didn't change things. What it did was wake people up to what's been going on for a very long time. And it's a deep problem.
Lawrence Tribe is co-author of Uncertain Justice, The Robert Courts and the Constitution. Lawrence Tribe, callers for you. Let's go to them, if I may. Mike in Boston, you're on the air with Lawrence Tribe.
Hi, Tom. I have to tell you I disagree with your guest there in his statement that it's not a right-leaning court or a conservative court. I would challenge him to name one ruling that any of the conservative, at least in my opinion, conservative justices have ruled on that would be considered a ruling that was for the benefit of the poor or the working poor or the lower class or just any progressive thinking. I would challenge him to give me one case where any of these judges, again, Scalia, Thomas, the fellow whose wife is actually a Tea Party member, I just highly disagreed with him on that point. I think it's this court has been very politically motivated and has undermined our society and will continue to undermine our society.
Mike, let me take your challenge right to Lawrence Tribe. You know, name one where, of course, he's not asking about the whole court. He's asking about who he perceives as conservative members of the court. But how do you respond, Lawrence?
Well, certainly Justice Kennedy is a conservative, and he voted to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. The reason the court has not ruled in a way that would help the poor isn't that they hate the poor. It's that we have a very conservative Congress these days, and there is no new legislation to benefit working and poor people that the court has been grappling with. The court in the period from the 1890s to around 1937 repeatedly struck down laws designed to help working people. Struck down minimum wage laws, struck down laws protecting people in the workplace. This court hasn't been engaged in that enterprise. Besides, I guess my point to Mike would be, rather than agreeing or disagreeing offhand, why not look at the book? You don't have to buy it. You know, you can borrow it from somebody. But there's a lot of stuff in there that I think will kind of surprise people like Mike and like me, whose political leanings are very liberal. It's not that I wouldn't prefer a slightly differently composed court. I would, but elections have consequences. When Richard Nixon was elected, when Ronald Reagan was elected, when George W. Bush was put into power, though not literally the first time elected, the result was more conservative appointments. And conservatives generally on the court, and now I'm using the very language that I've said is an oversimplification, but I'm going to talk Mike's language for a minute. Conservatives on the court have tended to time their resignation so that a conservative president will replace them. Liberals haven't done that. And that's why for the last 50 years, we've had a series of appointments that on the issues of the working poor and some of the concerns that Mike is expressing, the court has moved gradually in a rightward direction.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Roberts Court, the John Roberts Court, our Supreme Court, and where it is taking the country with constitutional law scholar Lawrence Tribe, co-author of the new book Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. He's arguing back against the widely held perception that we have a more polarized court, perhaps a more partisan court than we have had in years past. He says, look under the covers. There's a lot of nuance in there. There are recordings of the proceedings at the court now, and justices speak outside the court. You want a sense of the perspective of at least one? Antonin Scalia here, talking at the Oxford Union in England in 2007, defended himself as a constitutional originalist and attacked Roe v. Wade on abortion.
You think there ought to be a right to abortion? No problem. The Constitution says nothing about it. create it the way most rights are created in a democratic society, pass a law. And that law, unlike a constitutional right to abortion created by a court, can compromise. It can see, oh, I was going to say it can split the baby. I should not use it. The Constitution is not meant to facilitate change. It is meant to impede change, to make it difficult to change.
The Constitution is meant to impede change, Justice Scalia saying there. And do justices come without connection to their former lives? No. In February, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor talked to law students at Yale University, talked about growing up poor in the Bronx and how that upbringing might influence her on the Supreme Court.
When the president called me to tell me he had selected me as his nominee for the Supreme Court, he asked two things of me. And one of the two was to stay connected to my community. And my response on that one was, Mr. President, I don't know how to do anything else.
Justice Sotomayor. Lawrence Tribe joins me in the studio. With us as well right now from Arlington, Virginia, is Naomi Rao, professor of constitutional law at George Mason University. She served as counsel to President George W. Bush. Naomi Rao, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We think of you as kind of a conservative interpreter of the law. Lawrence Tribe often is a liberal interpreter, though in his new book, he's looking at all kinds of nuance here. Do you see a court that is coming to the defense of more conservative positions on the Constitution in the Roberts Court, Naomi?
I think it's, you know, the general characterization of the Roberts Court as a court that tends to lean more conservative is, I think, fair. But what I very much appreciate about Professor Tribe's book is that he suggests it's not, you know, characterizing a court is not a simplistic endeavor, that focusing on 5-4 decisions doesn't often tell us very much about the real underlying jurisprudential and legal differences amongst the justices. And so I think this idea of trying to explore the nuances of what the court is doing and to do that with a broader public, not just with lawyers and law professors, is a very worthwhile endeavor.
Do you fear that we have a more partisan or ideological court, or that its reputation for that has grown? Do you see that as just a trope of liberal observers? Or, I mean, there are two sides to every coin, right? Do we have a more partisan or political or ideological court today, divided, you describe it, than in the past?
I don't think that it's fair to say that it is a partisan court or a political court in the way that most people refer to it. I think that the differences that you see amongst the justices come from really foundational differences about how they think about the law, what values they find in the Constitution, and how they apply those understandings of the law and the values behind the Constitution to particular cases. I think there are real differences, and I don't think the differences boil down to, you know, partisan ideas about trying to pick their favorite position.
Larry Tribe, what about the 5-4? Just on the face of it, it seems we have many more of them. Now, you say that they align in different ways. You don't always have the same members, and that's quite true, though there are trends there. But for people of a certain generation, this repeated observation of headlines that come out saying 5-4 is a little unsettling. I think people have a sense of a time when somehow the court reached more consensus more often.
The fact is, if you look over time, we don't have an unusually high number of 5-4s. About 80% of the rulings are decided by clear, non-ideological majorities. Another 8% are decided by close votes involving unusual alignments of justices. I mean, sometimes they're 5-4, but when one of the four is a so-called liberal joined by three so-called conservatives, and when there are equal flips on the other side, that just tells you that nose counting, simple arithmetic, is going to mislead you as to what's really going on. I mean, the future and the problems of the future are not necessarily going to be about affirmative action and about religion in town meetings and the things that are most explosive and divisive right now. They might be about things like DNA collection or the you know, what's going to happen with the government's collection of metadata. Those are terribly important things. And on those issues, the court's divisions are not at all along standard partisan or ideological lines. You constantly find Justice Scalia as the champion of people's privacy, something that matters every bit as much to a poor person as a rich person. Mm-hmm. And you often find Justice Breyer going along with the government's attempt to engage in more surveillance, more searches, and less protection of privacy. In area after area, and probably the growth industries in legal dispute, the divisions, though they're going to persist because the problems are close and difficult and the values are in conflict, are not partisan divisions. Take a case that's pending right now involving two different kinds of rights, the rights of reproductive freedom and control over one's destiny in the sexual realm, mm-hmm. rights including abortion, and on the other side, freedom of speech. The 35-foot buffer zone that's at issue in a case from Massachusetts.
Abortion clinics.
About abortion clinics, right. Is it a liberal or a conservative thing to rule one way or the other in that case? It's a question of accommodating competing values. And the principles that are used by the court in deciding where to strike the balance are at least as important for the future of reproductive privacy and for the future of free speech as the bottom line question of whether a 35-foot buffer zone can be built around abortion clinics.
What about some of these passionate defenses or dissents, I should say, we've heard from the bench in this court? There again, it strikes me as unusual. I see it described as unusual. And from the outside, an observer might think, well, that's the sound of justices really worrying about polarization, that the decisions are coming down so far afield from their own view that it's a cri de coeur from the bench. How do you understand what's going on there?
I think justices feel that in a world where there is so much yelling and screaming, sometimes they're going to have to speak more vocally themselves in order to be heard. They are realistic. They know that not everybody reads their opinions. They know that despite books like this, the attempt to get people to be nuanced may not succeed. And so they want to say something that's going to make it to the front page of the local paper and of the New York Times rather than simply bury their views in written dissents. But the differences in view are not necessarily more passionate than they were before. I mean, there are cases in the late 19th century, cases in the period of, you know, the early 20th, mm-hmm. where the differences of view were overwhelming. FDR ran and won a presidential election mm-hmm. over his battle with the United States Supreme Court and the question of how much power both the Congress and the states could have to regulate the economy and build a safety net and mm-hmm. help create a more level playing field. So these divisions are not new.
The style
may be different. I think it would be better if the court were to open itself up to greater public view, if the public could actually see the justices in oral argument grappling with these issues. I mean, some of them are better than others at zingers and one-liners. Kagan is terrific at it. So is Scalia. So is Alito. Some justices think out loud with elaborate hypotheticals like Justice Breyer. Part of what our book does is give a sense of the different personal styles mm-hmm. of the nine justices. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a sad thing when the court finally locked even its front doors to the public. In 2010, for security reasons, these mm-hmm. great bronze doors at the front of the Supreme Court.
The Marble Palace,
mm-hmm. yes, were slammed shut. So no longer do people walk up those famous 44 steps under the phrase equal justice under law. They have to sneak in the side.
Yeah.
I think that whatever the security arguments, I think it was a valuable thing that Breyer and Ginsburg dissented from the court's decision to lock those doors because that tells a sad story about access to justice.
Liz in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Mr. Tribe. Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Tribe. Mm-hmm. You seem to imply that overall the court is not is not politicized. But when I look at a case like Citizens United, it was decided on constitutional grounds, which makes it very difficult to make changes. And further, they, in both Citizens United and McCutcheon, have narrowed the definition of corruption so much that it is very, very hard to get any reform other than a constitutional amendment through. And so that's why a large proportion of the population is trying to get a constitutional amendment. And just disclosure is only a small part of the problem.
Well, Liz, I agree that when the court decides a case on the basis of the Constitution, by definition, only a constitutional amendment can overturn what the court has done. But there are reforms that sometimes remain possible. This is an area where I'm afraid I agree, and my book explains why I agree, that the court has gone farther than perhaps it should have with respect to knocking down virtually every attempt to restrict the influence of money in politics. But that's quite a different question from politicization or polarization. The court has a view of the First Amendment, a view that I think a lot of people celebrate when it comes out in favor of dissidents and dissenters, and a view that they don't celebrate when it comes out in favor of this or that corporation. But it's got nothing to do with whether it's a conservative or a liberal corporation. I mean, Citizens United happened to involve an anti-Hillary Clinton film, but you can be certain that if it had instead involved an anti-John McCain film or an anti-Barack Obama film or something else, the result would have been the same, whether it's the Koch brothers or George Soros, who is funding stuff. The court's view that when Congress tries to fine-tune the volume and source of speech, it creates real dangers for an open society. That view, which may have been carried too far, is a view that naturally is expressed in constitutional terms, and by definition, it's going to be hard to change. The fact that it would take a constitutional amendment to change it, however, is not necessarily a reason to think that that's the best way to go. The support for an amendment is not as deep and broad as it would need to be to make it very likely. And there's a reason we've only had 27 amendments in 225 years. It's deliberately hard to do.
You've got a lot of equanimity there, at least in your delivery. Charles in Buffalo, you're on the air with Lawrence Tribe and Naomi Rao. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Professor Tribe, Ms. Rao. To the question of the polarization issue, really, I think what we find, are beginning to find, two things. One, certainly there is a clash of values and mores, or the evolution of values and mores as they are interpreted by Supreme Court decisions. It is clearly, by the, at least in some measure, the 5-4 decisions on those critical issues. Now, some of those critical issues are certainly based in the First Eight Amendments. A lot of them are the social construct. And I think what happens, it appears what has happened is, again, because the values and mores of these particular men and women may be different because of their respective upbringings, you get that close calls on those things that we determine to be fundamental to our requisite existence in this country. The Supreme Court obviously has the power to interpret that kind of movement of values and mores that's inherent in their mission. But they don't seem to talk about the balancing act that is required in the deliberative process to, in fact, assure that people understand that a 5-4 decision has to do with we're moving, but we can't be moving that fast, okay? That kind of concept, I would argue, Dr. Tribe, is a part of that process that appears to be, because again, as you said, the polarization, I should say, the mass media communications and the word turning a phrase becomes more important than the kind of mental acuity that is required in order to move the social construct a little further along to accept either a broadening or a narrowing of a specific set of rights.
Charles, I appreciate your call. Our time grows so short. Naomi Rao, do you see the Roberts Court? I mean, John Roberts is a young man for Supreme Court justice. He could be Chief Justice for a long time still. Do you see us likely coming out the other side of his tenure there with a changed country in terms of constitutional interpretation, the framework of life that it gives us?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court obviously has a big impact on our Constitution, in part precisely because it is so hard to change decisions of the Supreme Court except by an amendment or by a subsequent decision of the Supreme Court. And I think a lot of, you know, the impact of the Roberts Court will depend on subsequent appointments to that court, you know, as, you know, older justices retire, depending on, you know, future elections, that will have a big impact because the chief, although a very important institutional player on the court, still needs four other votes if he wants to shift the court's direction.
Naomi Rao, it's great to have you with us today from George Mason University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lawrence Tribe, we read carefully here because it matters to us all. This, we want to have the sense of the court is somehow, in some degree, above and beyond the fray. We don't want junior varsity politicians there. Stephen Breyer's concerned about the perception of the court. You take us closer to seeing maybe some comfort there, and we thank you for that. The new book is Uncertain Justice. Lawrence Tribe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.